from the preface to William Caxton's Aeneidos. And certainly, our language now used varieth far from that which was used and spoken when I was born. For we Englishmen been born under the domination of the moon, which is never steadfast, but ever wavering, waxing one season, and waneth and disgraceth another season. And that common English that is spoken in one share varieth from another in so much that in my days happened that certain merchants were in a ship in Thames for to have sailed over the sea into Zealand, and for lack of wind they tarried at a foreland and went to land for to refresh them. And one of them, named Sheffield, a mercer, came into an house and asked for meat, and specially he asked after eggs. And the good wife answered that she could speak no French. And the merchant was angry, for he also could speak no French, but would have had eggs. And she understood him not. And then at last another said that he would have iron. Then the good wife said that she understood him well. Lo, what should a man in these days know right, eggs or iron? Sir Thomas Wyatt's song, My Lute. My lute, awake, perform the last labour that thou and I shall waste, an end that I have now begun. For when this song is sung and past, may lute be still, for I have done. As to be hard where air is known, as lead to grave in marble stone, may song may pass her heart as soon. Should we then sigh, or sing, or moan? No, no, my lute, for I have done. The rocks do not so cruelly repulse the waves continually as she may suit an affection, so that I am past remedy, whereby my lute and I have done. Proud of her spoil that thou hast got of simple hearts thorough love's shot, by whom, unkind, thou hast them won, think not he hath his bow forgot, although my lute and I have done. Vengeance shall fall on thy disdain that makes but game on earnest pain. Think not alone under the sun, unquit to cause thy lover's plain, although my lute and I have done. Perchance thee lie, weathered and old, the winter nights that are so cold, clinging in vain unto the moon. Thy wishes then dare not be told. Care then who list, for I have doomed. And then may chance thee to repent the time that thou hast lost and spent, to cause thy lovers sigh and swoon. Then shalt thou know beauty but lent, and wish and want as I have done. Now cease, my lute, this is the last labour that thou and I shall waste, an end it is that we begun. Now is the song both sung and past, may lute be still, for I have done. From Spenser's Amoretti. Like as a huntsman, after weary chase, seeing the game from him escaped away, sits down to rest him in some shady place, with panting hounds beguiled of their prey. So after long pursuit and vain essay, when I all weary had the chase forsook, the gentle deer returned the self-same way, thinking to quench her thirst at the next brook. There she beholden me with milder look, sought not to fly, but fairly still did bide, till I, in hand, her yet half trembling took, and in her own good will her firmly tied. Strange thing me seemed to see a beast so wild, so goodly one, with her own will beguiled. From Spenser's Epithalamion. Ye learned sisters, which have oftentimes been to me aiden, others to adorn, whom ye thought worthy of your graceful rhymes, that e'en the greatest did not greatly scorn to hear their names sung in your simple lays, but joyed in their praise. And when ye list your own mishaps to mourn, which death or love or fortune's wreck did raise, your strings could soon to sadder tenor turn, and teach the woods and waters to lament your doleful dreariment. Now lay those sorrowful complaints aside, and having all your heads with girdle crown, help me mine own love's praises to resound, ne let the same of any be envied, so Orpheus did for his own bride. So I unto myself alone will sing, the woods shall to me answer and my echo ring. Early before the world's light-given lamp his golden beam upon the hills doth spread, having dispersed the night's uncheerful damp, do ye awake, and with fresh lusty head go to the bower of my beloved love, my truest turtle dove. Bid her awake, for Hymen is awake, and long since ready forth his mask to move, with his bright tail that flames with many a flake, and many a bachelor to wait on him, in their fresh garments trim. Bid her awake, therefore, and soon her doubt, for lo, the wished day is come at last, that shall for all the pains and sorrows past pay to her usury of long delight. And whilst she doth her doubt, do ye to her of joy and solace sing, that all the woods may answer and your echo ring. Selections from Shakespeare. Sonnet 33. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. Anon permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly wreck on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace. E'en so my sun on early morn did shine with all triumphant splendor on me brow. But out, alack, he was but own or mine, the raging cloud hath masked him from me now. Yet him for this me love no whit disdaineth, sons of the world may stain when heaven's sun staineth. Sonnet 71. No longer mourn for me when I am dead, than you shall hear the surly, sullen bell give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world with vilest worms to dwell. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it, for I love you so that I in your sweet thoughts would be forgot if thinking on me then should make you woe. Oh, if I say you look upon this verse when I, perhaps, compounded am with clay, do not so much as my poor name rehearse, but let your love, e'en with my life, decay, lest the wise world should look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. Twelfth Night, Act One, Scene One. If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiten the appetite may sicken, and so die. That strain again, it had a dying fall. Oh, it came o'er me ere, like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing and given order. Enough, no more. 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. O sprite of love, how quick and fresh art thou, that notwithstanding thy capacity receiveth as the sea, naught enters there of what validity and pitch soe'er, but falls into abatement and low price, e'en in a minute. So full of shapes is fancy, that it alone is high fantastical. A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 5, Scene 1. More strange than true, I never may believe there's antique fables, nor there's fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shapen fantasies, that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. On sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy northern a local habitation and a name. Such tricks hath strong imagination, that if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. Or in the night, imagining some fair, how easy is a bush supposed a bear. King Henry the Fourth, Part 1, Act 1, Scene 3. My liege, I did deny no prisoners. But I remember when the fight was done, when I was dry with rage and extreme toil, breathless and faint, leaning upon me sword, came there a certain lord, neat and trimly dressed, fresh as a bridegroom, and his chin new raped showed like a stubble land at harvest home. He was perfumed like a milliner, and twixt his finger and his thumb he held a pouncet box, which ever and anon he gave his nose, and took it away again, who therewith angry, when it next came there, took it in snuff. And still he smiled and talked, and as the soldiers bore dead bodies by, he called them untaught knaves, unmannerly to bring a slovenly, unhandsome corpse betwixt the wind and his nobility. With many holiday and lady terms he questioned me, amongst the rest demanded my prisoners in your majesty's behalf. I then, all smarting with me wounds being called, to be so pestered with a popingay, out of my grief and my impatience, answered neglectingly I know not what. He should or he should not, for he made me mad to see him shine so brisk and smell so sweet, and talk so like a waiting gentlewoman of guns and drums and wounds, God save the mark. and telling me the sovereign thing on earth was Parmacity for an inward bruise. And that it was great pity, so it was, this villainous saltpeter should be digged out of the bowels of the harmless earth, which many a good tall fellow had destroyed so cowardly. And but for these vile guns, he would himself have been a soldier. This bold, unjointed chat of his, my lord, I answered indirectly, as I said, and I beseech you, let not his report come current for an accusation betwixt my love and your high majesty. From the same play, Act 2, Scene 4. Harry, I do not only marvel where thou spendest thy time, but also how thou art accompanied. For though the chamomile, the more it is trodden on, the faster it grows, yet youth, the more it is wasted, the sooner it wears. That thou art my son, I have partly thy mother's word, partly my own opinion, but chiefly a villainous trick of thine eye, and a foolish hanging on thy nether lip that doth warrant me. If then thou be son to me, here lies the pint. Why, being son to me, art thou so pinted at? Shall the blessed Son of Heaven prove a mitcher and eight blackberries, a question not to be asked? Shall the Son of England prove a thief and take purses, a question to be asked? There is a thing, Harry, which thou hast often heard of, and it is known to many in our land by the name of pitch. This pitch, as ancient writers do report, doth defile. So doth the company thou keepest. For, Harry, no, I do not speak to thee in drink, but in tears, not in pleasure, but in passion, not in words only, but in woes also. And yet there is a Varter's man, whom I have often noted in thy company, but I know not his name. A goodly, portly man, if aith, and a corpulent, of a cheerful look, a pleasant eye, and a most noble carriage, and, as I think, his age some 50 or burlady inclining to 80. And now I remember me, his name is Falstaff. If that man should be lewdly given, he deserveth me. For, Harry, I see Varter in his looks. If then the tree may be known by the fruit, as the fruit be the tree, then peremptorily I spake it, there is Varter in that Falstaff. Him keep, the rest banish. Antony and Cleopatra, Act 2, Scene 2. The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne burned on the water. The poop was baton gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke, and made the water which they bait to follow faster as amorous of their strokes. For her own parson it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold of tissue, or picturing that Venus, where we see the fancy outwork nature. On each side her stood pretty dimpled boys, like smiling cupids with divers colored fans, whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks, which they did cool, and what they undid did. Her gentle women, like the Nereids, so many mermaids tended her i' the eyes, and made their bends adornings. At the helm a seeming mermaid steers, the silken tackle swelled with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yearly frame the office. From the barge a strange invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharfs. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned i' the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to there, which, but for vacancy, had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature.